Welcome back to Techtopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have writer and professor Bill LeBoon. This is Techtopia.
This episode is partially sponsored by Sanebox. So look, guys, I hate email. I get thousands of messages a day, and I miss all the important ones and get stuck reading the junk. I despise email as a workplace distraction, and it's one that eats up a great gobs of our attention, which could be better spent on more meaningful work. I agree with all of that. The question is, what would you do if you got that time and attention back? What would you do with 2 more hours in each week? About 4. That's how much time Sanebox saves their average user every single week. With just a few clicks, Sanebox automatically gets your email under control and makes keeping it that way forever super easy. It also has some sweet features like one-click unsubscribe, which sends annoying emails to the aptly named Black Hole, and automatic tracking of messages that haven't been received replies so you can see what needs following up on. I want you all to see how Sanebox can help you reclaim your time and attention with a free 2-week trial. Visit sanebox.com/techno today to start your free trial and get a $25 credit. That's Sanebox, sanebox.com/techno. Thanks for listening.
3, 2, 1. Welcome back to Techtopia, the podcast of whatever. I keep messing this up. Welcome back to Techtopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Bill LeBoon. He's a professor and writer who lives in Pittsburgh. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah, super. So you're not a professor. You're a teacher of some sorts.
Yes.
I don't quite understand what that means.
Yeah, so technically I'm a lecturer, which means rather than my focus really being on research, even though I do some research, my focus is on teaching. Mm-hmm. That's really, you know, where my heart lies. I like teaching people things.
But it's computer science teaching. It's not teaching like basket weaving or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I'm in the computer science department, so I mostly teach software engineering, quality assurance. I'm teaching a special topics course on blockchain technology and cryptocurrency this semester. Mm-hmm. I teach a variety of computer science related courses.
Okay, is the entirety of the educational system going to go belly up in the next 2 years?
Well, I'd give it at least 3. we'll see. I'm doing my best to keep it afloat.
So, I mean, I guess the reason why I asked that is that everybody's saying that the idea of first off that for-profit colleges or even non-profit colleges are basically going to be shutting down. There's too many of them. There's a glut, right?
I think no one would disagree with that. There are a lot of colleges out there that aren't really providing what they really should be doing—a good academic background for students.
Mm-hmm. So, what's the future in terms of education, especially computer education, like? I want to learn Kotlin for myself, so I ordered the book, and I'm going to sit here and I'm going to learn it a little bit. I'm just wondering why someone needs to go to school to learn, I don't know, Kotlin or Django or whatever.
To learn a specific technology or a language, mm-hmm. That's really not what I see a school for. When I want to learn a language, you know, so like recently I picked up Rust, you know, very, very interesting language. And how did I do it? Well, there are a lot of resources online. You know, I could teach myself. When I became a Ruby developer, it was the same thing. I picked up some Rails tutorials. I learned it myself enough, at least, to get going. But what I really see a role for a more like traditional academic education is, you know, getting the foundations, like really understanding data structures and being able to create projects and try things and get feedback on them from somebody who is experienced in that sort of safe environment. So it's one thing to just learn syntax, right? Learn new syntax. But how do I develop, an API that's going to be understandable and maintainable and that is going to be efficient and performant? What are some foundational principles? What kind of data structures can I use? What kind of architectures I can use? And, you know, there's always the argument that this could be done in, you know, just an industry that just go off and start a startup and start working on it. But what I really think an academic education provides is the ability to do that in an environment where you can be criticized without, you know, causing a multi-million-dollar mm-hmm. failure. You can figure out what works, what doesn't, get feedback on what your problems are. So that's what I think that sort of, you know, old-fashioned education is still very useful for, even in computer science.
Interesting. So that's an interesting point. So basically the university is a place where you can go to, where you can go to mess up, right? But is I guess the question there is, how do you judge a university's ability to train you in failure, when especially in technology? And maybe this is too esoteric, but I guess the you specifically are going to be able to teach folks how to what to think about when they see blockchain, and be, I guess, skeptical and be understanding and be cognizant of the whole thing. What is it that a university requires to ensure that message is taken correctly, and that it's able to be used in actual work environment?
So I think that what the university really, you know, should bring to the table are faculty, you know, people that are teaching the classes that do understand this, that have made the mistakes, right, that have gone through the school of hard knocks themselves and, you know, discovered these problems, and also give the chance for students to do things in such a way that it's similar to how they would do it in industry. So all of my classes, for example, are very project-based, because I spent, you know, 15 years at a variety of companies. I have never been given a test outside of an interview. No one has said, like, well, if you can finish this problem in 30 minutes with no Googling, then you can, get the contract. I think that, you know, what academia has to do, at least, again, in our field, is to really continue to make things more industry focused, more project focused, like what students are doing, while still providing them the theoretical framework and grounding and foundation that they would get from a more traditional education.
Mm-hmm. All right, very cool. Yeah, it's just something I was thinking about in terms of why do we need schools? I understand why I needed, I went to CMU down the street from you guys. You're at Pitt. I understand why I needed that, but I don't understand how to explain to the world that they still need it. And everybody's really frustrated with the price of university, et cetera, et cetera. You wrote a novel on blockchain. Why don't we talk about that a little bit? Tell us what the story is there.
Okay. So I wrote a novel, Strength in Numbers, a novel of cryptocurrency, which is a book set about 20 years in the future, where traditional money has been made obsolete by a variety of cryptocurrencies. So it's actually set at the University of Pittsburgh. You know, they say write what you know. Mm-hmm. So it's actually an English lit major who discovers that there may be the key to 5 Bitcoin in her apartment, that there was a researcher who had left the key for 5 Bitcoin in her apartment. And part of the novel is not just her, you know, figuring out how to find this with the help of some of her friends. So along the way, the reader also figures out how Bitcoin works, because, you know, to the people 20 years from now, it'll be like asking, well, how does electricity work? You know, mm-hmm. I don't know. I just flip the switch. You know, I don't know. I put the phone and the money goes over there. But of course, you know, it turns out to be there's more to this than it seems, and she sort of gets sucked into an adventure.
And it's on Amazon right now. Why did you write a novel instead of a nonfiction book?
So I had already, you know, I had written my textbook. I'd wanted to try a hand at fiction, and I also noticed there weren't any, as far as I could tell, any novels or, you know, that really explored this topic. There was already a lot of, you know, there are a lot of great books out there, nonfiction on the history of Bitcoin, or, you know, how blockchain, you know, is going to impact the world. But I didn't see anything out there that, you know, told a story about what this world was going to be like. Mm-hmm. It all seemed kind of, you know, disconnected, like, oh, we'll be able to do X, we'll be able to do Y. But I was thinking, all right, how is this going to impact society? What's life going to be like on a day-to-day basis? How is it going to be different? And I thought that, you know, writing a book would allow me to explore this, as well as, you know, be, I think, pretty interesting to others. Like, as we are, I think, in the beginnings, really, of like the cryptocurrency revolution. And that sounds a little cliche, but mm-hmm. I really believe it. And so how are all these things going to be, like, impact our world, you know, going forward? And I think generally in positive ways. So the book actually has some sort of like fictional nonfiction in it. I have like what are basically newspaper clippings from The Econometrician, which is a pretty thinly veiled reference to a current day newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And with different news snippets of like, you know, what's happening in the world as the characters are also living in it. Like, how is it impacting sort of like larger scale things like at with businesses and politics? Because I think it's going to have an influence not just on how individuals live, but just how societies are sort of put together and substantiated.
Hmm. What's the why do you think that cryptocurrency folks can't? Or why isn't cryptocurrency compelling enough for more people to write about it in that way? Is it hard to understand? Is it that cryptocurrency folks just don't have that sort of imagination?
I'm not sure. I wouldn't say that. I mean, I would say that cryptocurrency people certainly have a lot of imagination, and I've seen sort of very short stories online, on Reddit and on Twitter about things that can happen. I think it's really it's like multiple different skills, like, being able to write well and understanding cryptocurrency well enough to really, say something about it. A Venn diagram where I would say the intersection is not that large.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we are still early in this space, and there have definitely been, novels that have talked about it sort of, or around the edges of it, like Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson.
Yep.
in the 90s. I mean, he certainly talked about a sort of cryptocurrency, even though it's very different than what we see as Bitcoin today. So I think that, and I know there's the classic, like Star Trek always talks about credits and, gold press latinum and stuff. So people have talked about money, but I think it was a little bit difficult writing it to at first think, all right, how can I make a story, that's going to be compelling and interesting and full of plot, that also explains, how things are going to be. It's kind of a little bit of an odd combination.
Yeah, I mean, there are some writers who do that. Something like, what was the one about the flat world? Remember that book?
Yeah, I think it was Flatland. I was calling
Flatland. And there are a couple other ones that are similar to that. And some of the sci-fi novelists have done. Kind of do that where they basically take a topic and kind of beat into the ground using fiction. And I don't think this is the case here. I think it's an interesting point that it hasn't been a plot point. It's trying to grow. How did you write this moving from an academic background into something a little more creative like that?
So sort of 15 minutes at a time. So, mm-hmm. I've got a young son. He just turned 5 this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always, since he was younger, he loved stories. And so I started telling him stories. I've got, all different kinds of stories and little alternate universes that I have for talking with him. And I feel like that's, as I did that, I started thinking like, I guess I'm pretty good at this. At least my son likes it. And he's,
mm-hmm.
And so I started just when I had some time sitting down and thinking of the story. And the more I started thinking about it, the more it all started to come together. Like, things and I wanted to keep writing more and more into my mapping it out. And then my mm-hmm. told me like, oh, this is really interesting. And like the way you've explained it, you've been able to. She's not a technical person, but I was able to explain it in a non-technical way. And she's like, you should put that in there. You should put that in there. And pretty soon, I'm like, oh, this is really coming together. So I sort of made a big push to get it, get all together into a final form and sent out.
Hmm. Fascinating. All right, very cool. What do you think? What do you think blockchain and all that stuff looks like in 20 years?
So I think it's going to have a huge impact on the world. And I know everybody right now, they're talking about price and Ether's doing this and Bitcoin's doing that. But I think that blockchain itself has in the idea of this coming to a consensus without any sort of centralized intermediary has some really big impacts on the world, which, as I mentioned, I think are generally positive. So I think a big thing is we now have, this way of communicating value, right? So the internet allows us to communicate information or data, but now we have a way to communicate value, to send value, without any sort of specific intermediary, and also to do it in an entirely transparent way. So if you say that, you know, all right, here's my Bitcoin address, I can now send you a Bitcoin, and you can't come back to me later and say that, like, no, Laboon, you didn't send that to me. I say, no, you know, we go to Blockchain Explorer, we can see, here it is, here. Everything is extremely transparent. And think about how many things you do in your life now that are entirely opaque. You know, that if you want to you know, get some money from your bank, it's like, unless you go and balance your checkbook, you really just depend upon, all right, the bank's, you know, system is doing everything correctly, right? If you want to you know, buy a house, I've always thought this is kind of ridiculous. Like, you have to get title insurance, as you know, there's no way to verify transparently and authoritatively that the person that sold you the house actually owns it. And I say, well, we have these technologies now. You know, developing a society from scratch right now, we wouldn't be using, like, you know, or people to go search in the musty halls down at City Hall to figure out who owns a property. You know, we could put it on a database. And if we wanted to make sure that everybody could determine this and who owns it and make it, you know, open, we could very easily put it on a blockchain. So I think, you know, these are just, like, you know, two specific examples. But I think that this is going to apply to a lot of things. We now have ways to do things in a transparent manner that we just did not have the ability to do before we had blockchain and related technologies.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting point. I mean, I think when is it, is this ever going to become, is this like Unix, is this like Linux on the desktop where every year it gets a little further away, or is this like Linux on the server where it just essentially everybody's excited about it right now for about 5 years and then it kind of fades into the background and just becomes part of everyday life?
Yeah, so I think, you know, just like, you know, we talk about Linux on the desktop, but, you know, so many people are using Android phones, which, you know, we're carrying around Linux and we don't even really, you know, think about it. You know, electricity, radio was a huge, you know, interesting thing. And people would talk about, all right, exactly what kind of, you know, antenna we're going to use and all sorts of whatever. I'm not a radio person, but I know my friends that are ham radio people, and they can talk for hours about, like, you know, what kind of angle we would set the antenna to and all this stuff. Like, for most people, though, it's like they go in the car and they press the button. So I think that from a public perspective, we may not see as much about blockchain. But like you said, like with Linux on the server, it's like, well, it's going to start taking over as people sort of see the benefits, I think. And then they'll just assume that, of course, if I want to know, you know, if I own this property, I'll be able to look it up. Of course, and just, you know, I will know it's true and I'll easily be able to verify it. Of course, it was ridiculous for people to use credit cards where you just gave someone a number and they could withdraw as much money from your account as they wanted. And then it was up to the bank to look at it later. People are going to, I really feel like people are going to just, you know, look back and they're, if they ever really think about it, just like we think about, you know, the silliness from, you know, the 40s and 50s, and it's going to fade into the background of their everyday life, but they're going to see the benefits, right? Just spam prevention. I don't know. I think you were around, like, in the early 90s when spam was just absolutely rampant. But nowadays, it's pretty rare that I get spam in my inbox, but I don't think about, like, all the cool Bayesian filters and stuff that have been implemented to make that happen. Even though all this, like, cool technology is happening in the background, we as the public may not realize it.
Sure. Yeah. I remember I was talking with Captain Crunch, John Draper.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he made his own spam filter. It was basically just a spell checker and some other stuff that he had set up for himself. And it was just basically a filter that way. And this was like almost 20 years ago. And now I haven't seen I honestly don't see spam. That's actually a very, very good point. All right. Very cool. What's your next book going to be about?
Oh, so I've considered a couple of different things. I've thought about writing a fantasy novel, but honestly, I've got some more textbooks that I want to write. I want to do this. I have a friendly introduction to software testing, and I want to write a second edition simply because the software testing world has changed pretty dramatically since I originally wrote it.
All right, very cool. And what the title of the previous book again? Let's get that out there so people can grab it.
Yeah, Strength in Numbers, a novel of cryptocurrency. So it's available in paperback or on ebook, Kindle, all that should be available.
All right, let's close this up. All right, thanks, Bill, for joining us on Technotopia. This has been Technotopia. I'm John Biggs. We will see you next week.
Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.
Technotopia is also sponsored by Jaywalk. Jaywalk is a new app that pays you to walk. You can try it out at jaywalk.me. It's created by me, John Biggs, and a few of my friends. Jaywalk.me, please check it out.